live from the Valley of the Sun, sharing the news unedited, untainted, and unscreened. The real news you'll never hear on Fox, CNN, or NBC. Serious issues affecting all fellow Americans and the world. The man whose website is monitored by more feds than Osama bin Laden. The man who truly is not ready to make nice. Here's Michael Herzog with The American Awakening.
All right, folks, we're back. Second hour of The American Awakening with your host, Michael Herzog, and my special guest, Professor Emeritus Jim Fetzer, talking about his article, Has Cheney Been Murdering Americans?, which you can find on Op-Ed News. You can find on my website, theamericanawakening.org, or you can find on Jim's website, assassinationscience.com. And, Jim, touching real quickly a little bit more regarding Paul Wellstone, which we'll jump back and forth a little bit here, but you also depicted in your article that John Castella had made a discovery of the meteorological. How's that? No, that's not good either. you get the drift. Anyway, the ice crystals in the clouds, but Michael Rupert had reached the same conclusion in Crossing the Rubicon, his book that came out in 2004. And I'm curious here because it says here that Rupert had been contacted by someone in the business of assassinations who told him that some reinvigorated old white guys were in charge, that they were nobody to screw around with, and that he could anticipate there would be other strategic accidents in the future. Is this part of the reason why Rupert wound up leaving the country, do you know?
Well, I think it's probably got to do with the book as a whole, which is a massive indictment of 9/11 and of Dick Cheney's central role in executing the whole operation. I mean, what Rupert has done is not focus on the scientific or physical evidence so much as he has a whole lot of circumstances, witnesses, and other reports that he's pieced together in his own brilliant fashion to bring an indictment against Dick Cheney. I think this work as a whole is probably the reason why he would be targeted. I mean, he'd be a perfect guy, in my opinion, for Cheney to plan to eliminate.
Okay, because I had wondered about that. I read the book, Crossing the Rubicon, and I know that it was right shortly after it was released, I believe, that he wound up leaving the country. And that was a fascinating book for anybody who hasn't read it, yeah.
What he's reporting there, it's very interesting, Michael, because he was doing an independent investigation. And he concluded, just as we had, that it was a directed energy weapon. And he had different sources than we had, such as this inside guy calling him up and telling him it was these reinvigorated old white guys. And, of course, you're describing Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. And when you say those words, and, you know, to me, it was just, very disturbing but also powerful corroboration that he, based on his investigation, and we, based on ours, had come to the same conclusion.
Well, in the other point that I wanted to make, and this is what's really bone-chilling here, Jim, is that, you know, that plane didn't just take out Wellstone. It took out his wife, his kids. It took out the pilots. I mean, this is a very extremely diabolical and a nefarious act for somebody to pull, which means that whoever pulled the trigger on this has no conscience, no soul, no empathy, no nothing. They're all in it for their political directives. And when you start looking at this in comparison with the plane crash of Mike Connell, you know, who was going to really testify regarding the voting fraud back in Ohio, or Beverly Eckert, which we're going to touch into next here, or the assassination of Pat Tillman, which we're going to go into a little bit later. I mean, you know, you're looking at some people who are extremely evil people. And then to add insult to injury to this, Jim, when we see Senators Leahy and Whitehouse that are talking about these terror investigations, we see the hubris of Cheney and Bush before they left office, you know, basically coming on Meet the Press and other shows and admitting that they indeed condone torture, yet nobody, with the exception of the nation of Spain, is doing anything about this. You know, you have to wonder what we have become as a people, Jim. Go ahead.
Oh, I couldn't agree more, Michael. And in fact, you see, a number of us have concluded that the Wellstone takeout was a refinement of the technique they used on Mel Carnahan 2 years earlier, where the very popular former governor was running against John Ashcroft for the Senate, and he went down in a plane crash about 3 weeks before under very mysterious circumstances. A radar fanatic who captures all kinds of anomalous radar events sent me images, which you can find on Assassination Science, of a huge red glow in the vicinity of the Carnahan crash at the time it took place, suggesting that something highly suspicious was taking place there, too. Now, the Carnahan crash was 3 weeks before the election, and the governor announced that if Carnahan was elected, even though he was deceased, he'd appoint his wife to succeed him. The people of Missouri preferred to vote for a dead man to sending John Ashcroft back to the Senate. He did appoint his wife, and I think what was going on here was you had a reduction in the timeline, so instead of 3 weeks, only 10 days, making it harder for the party to recover. And you had his wife aboard, so it wasn't the case that, you know, while Wellstone was dead, his wife could be appointed and serve after him. So I think we believe this was a refinement of the technique used in the Missouri Senate race. Now, you mentioned, too, about the control of the Senate being up for grabs. Actually, it had been 50-50, Democrats and Republicans, until Jim Jeffers of Vermont became an independent out of disillusionment with the Bush people because they wouldn't adequately fund the No Child Left Behind Act, which meant that no longer was it the case that Dick Cheney, in his role as president of the Senate, could cast the tie-breaking vote on behalf of the Republicans. Now it was split 50-49, and taking out Wellstone not only removed their foremost critic, a man who some believe might have even considered running for president himself, but changed the voting equation, so they regained that vote and made it 50-49, and then Max Cleland down in Georgia had his election stolen using these electronic voting machines, and it was very, very obvious to anyone who knows anything about software, because all these machines were giving exactly the same number from these different precincts, and there was something very strange going on there. Georgians have the tendency to elect governors and senators and leave them in office for long periods of time, so it was very strange that Max Cleland and the then governor would both lose their elections so quickly. But it wound up turning control of the Senate over to the Republicans, and of course it was all downhill after that. They just ran their juggernaut. In fact, Michael Rupert said that there were many congressmen who were confiding in him, and no doubt some senators too, that they thought it was all just too suspicious, the timing was too perfect, that this couldn't have been a coincidence. So there were many members of Congress who also believed that Wellstone had been taken out. Not only that, Michael, but as I mentioned in the article, he met with a group of veterans just shortly before his death and in Willmar, Minnesota, and told them that he had been told by Dick Cheney personally that if he opposed them on Iraq, that there would be severe ramifications for him personally and for the state of Minnesota. So here you have the vice president issuing a direct threat. Wellstone went ahead and did oppose them, and when he gave his speech against the war, he thought he might be throwing his political career away, but instead the people of Minnesota responded very positively, and he started pulling away from Coleman, and he was 6, 7, or 8 points ahead when the plane went down.
Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of birds to be killed with that one stone. You know, Cheney, interestingly enough, Cheney had that power, but also the power of, was it NORAD, was shifted over to Cheney from the military, was it back in June of 2001, shortly before 9/11? So
well, I
he
think
was
what
wielding
you're,
an immense.
You're thinking about, Michael, is that the responsibility for making a decision whether or not to shoot down passenger liners, for example, was taken away from a distributed responsibility and given to the exclusively to the Secretary of Defense, so that when he was unavailable, inaccessible on 9/11, they weren't authorized to shoot down these planes, although we do have a recent whistleblower coming forward now who claims that she was in the immediate vicinity and heard the decision being made to shoot down Flight 93, which is the plane that allegedly crashed at Shanksville. But, you know, that whole story about the Shanksville crash is so fantastic. They claim there's no signs of any debris there because the plane actually crashed into an abandoned mine shaft. But we know what to do, Mike, if, you know, with miners trapped in mine shafts. We get out the heavy equipment, the bright lights. We dig day and night, 24 hours a day, to see if we can save somebody by some sort of miracle. None of that was done here. In fact, the reporters and photographers were kept, 1,000 yards away. They weren't able to take any photographs. You'd think it would be better to have more photographs rather than less in case somebody catches something everyone else overlooked. There was this ditch in the ground. In fact, an Air Force expert on air crashes by the name of George Nelson told me that it looked to him as though someone had taken a bulldozer out there, dug a ditch, filled it with trash, and blown it up. There's this one photograph that's supposed to be showing the explosion of the clouds, but it turns out if you look at where the photograph was taken from purportedly in the crash scene, it's not in the right location. And the woman who purportedly took it has admitted it was a fake photograph. So I think we have here,
Okay, Jim, I got to stop you. I got to stop you. We got to take a break. We got to take a break. We'll be back in three. Michael Herzog with Jim Fetzer. Be right back. We're back with the American Awakening. Michael Herzog, your host, with my special guest, Professor Emeritus Jim Fetzer. And we were talking before the break about Flight 93, and interesting, it looked like somebody, you had mentioned somebody just went out there and dug a hole. But that brings up, on the topic of 9/11, we had this really diligent activist who turned down the money, the hush money that the government came out, Beverly Eckert, one of the Jersey girls, and she had just... she had just met with Barack Obama the week before, and I believe she was flying somewhere to see somebody regarding evidence. I don't know. Expound on that, Jim.
Well,
Talk about that a little bit.
There was some sort of memorial service for her husband, but there's also rumors floating that she was going to fly on to Chicago after this service in Buffalo in order to talk with the federal prosecutor there, the guy I think so well of, who the major prosecutor was, his name slipping my mind, tall, slender guy, really, really good. So that there's a possibility she was going to be doing that. I'm sure I mentioned it here. She had made a major contribution to getting the 9/11 investigation going. The Bush and Cheney didn't want to do it. And they actually put it off for like 441 days before the commission actually began to meet. And if it hadn't been for her and three other widows of 9/11, Patrick Fitzgerald, that's the guy I'm thinking about. If it hadn't been for her and three other 9/11 widows who refused to take the money, which most of us in the 9/11 research community regard as hush money, probably there wouldn't have even been a commission. I mean, it's absurd, Michael, because... after Pearl Harbor, FDR convened a commission within a week after the assassination of JFK, Lyndon also in a similar time frame. But these guys put it off and put it off and put it off. They obviously didn't want it to happen. They probably figured the more the delay, the more time for evidence to disappear, for memories to weaken, and all that sort of thing. So it was pretty clear they were acting like a bunch of mafia dons who didn't want to be, indicted and questioned about a crime. And I think the reasons are all too obvious. In fact, there was very, very damning statements even made by George Bush himself. You may recall when he was down in that school in Sarasota, I used to live there, and not far from the airport, in fact, where they had Air Force One Park. But not only did Andy Card come in and tell him, that the second tower had been hit and therefore America was under attack, and he just sits there with this blank expression while the school children read about a little girl and her pet goat. It's really quite absurd, claiming that he didn't want to upset them, but obviously it would have been very simple for him just to stand up and say, "I have to take care of some things, children. I'm really glad to have had the chance to visit with you." But he would later say on two different occasions, and this was all captured on tape, how when he saw the plane hit the first tower, he thought to himself, "Man, that's a really bad pilot." But what's funny about that, Michael, is the only time you'd ever think something like that or say something like that, even to yourself, would be before the second tower was hit. So he had to have actually seen the pilot hit the north tower and had those thoughts. And it had to be on some kind of closed-circuit television, probably a special network by the Secret Service, because even the footage on the hit by the North Tower by this French film team called the Naudet Brothers didn't show up until about 1 o'clock that night. So here got Bush saying that he actually saw it, and I suspect he actually did see whatever he saw on TV, a closed-circuit Secret Service network.
Well, but in light of that, Jim, you know, as we sat there and watched him, you know, read My Pet Goat for however many minutes it was, upside down from what I understand, you know, he was just nothing but more than a helpless puppet there. He knew what was going on, but he was just quarantined, was able to do nothing because he had no hand in it, as far as from my knowledge, but other than knowing what was going on.
But Rupert makes the case that Bush had designated Cheney to you know, coordinate the whole operation. Now, my opinion is that the reason he sat there expressionless is because if he'd come out and, say, gone on television to make a statement, other events were going to take place later on, such as at the Pentagon and involving Flight 93. So I think they didn't want him popping up and down like a jack-in-the-box on television. They wanted to wait until the whole thing had played out, and they knew that it hadn't played out yet. So that's why they delayed, I think, getting him on television.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be a plausible explanation. And, you know, going back to Beverly Eckert for a moment, and this flight, this Bombardier 400, you know, the anomalies are the same thing. New York Times was reporting icing, a significant ice buildup before the crash. That was in February 14th of 2009. And here we go. Here's a pristine aircraft that has de-icing boots. It's a commercial aircraft, so they have to be well maintained. And yet we've got the exaggerated report by the New York Times of ice buildup, which is nothing more to me than a diversion. And again, it's laughable because
here's the thing most Americans don't realize is that the CIA has its influence all over the mass media. I mean, Carl Bernstein, back in 1977, already published an article about the CIA and the media in Rolling Stone, in which he reported that officials, high officials from the agency, had boasted that their greatest successes had been with CBS News, with Time Life, and with the New York Times. In around those late 70s, if you controlled those three entities, Time Life, the New York Times, and CBS, you had pretty much a lock on the American news business. William Colby would later say that the CIA owned everyone of significance in the mass media. And, you know, I suspect that's probably true. It may be a reason why he disappeared while he was out kayaking on the Potomac one day.
Mm-hmm. And back on the subject of Beverly, you know,
Michael, is they can control the story, so they can control the storyline. If they want the storyline to be that it was icing, they can make sure the storyline is that there was icing. This goes back even to the JFK assassination, when Connie Kritzberg, who was a reporter for the Dallas Morning News, had a story about the wounds, and when she actually read her own story in the paper, it had been changed so that the doctors now didn't know if these wounds were caused by one bullet or two, and she confronted her editor over it, and he said that the FBI had called and wanted to be sure there wasn't any misunderstanding, and they'd made him write it that way. If you read a piece that Tom Wicker wrote, there's something very similar there that I think, again, reflects the influence of the FBI. Now, today, it's the CIA in manipulating the news and making the, you know, changing the words of the reporters before the story appears in print.
Well, look, as I said before, there was 10 people that went down in the Wellstone crash. On this particular flight, there was 50 people that lost their lives, if I remember correctly. And here we go again with them spinning the news, reporting the icing, the same anomaly as they reported on the Wellstone crash, which is total poppycock as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. But one thing and correct me if I'm wrong here, but the Jersey Girls to this day, well, at least up until the day that Beverly Eckert passed away, these girls were still pushing for a new investigation.
He's been meeting with Obama and pursuing it. And something I would like to accent is she wasn't necessarily a person who was convinced it was an inside job. She just felt that the truth hadn't been presented. And she, I think, was allied with a group of 9/11 researchers headed by a woman by the name of Barbara Ellis that had proposed legislation that would lead to investigation of 9/11 based upon considerations about the claim, the official story, that these fires caused the steel to weaken or to melt and to bring about the collapse of these buildings. Because if it's true that these fires could do that, then our building codes for our steel structure high-rise buildings are all over the country are defective. These were superb buildings. They were brilliantly engineered. It was a tube within a tube design. You had 47 core columns that were the main support structure. You had another 240 external support columns, and they were connected by steel trusses that were welded to the core columns and then welded to the support columns. And then they had 4 inches of concrete poured in for flooring.
Well, I hear the music. We got to take a break. We'll be back in three with my special guest, Jim Fetzer. We'll continue with this after the break. See you then. Folks, we're back with the American Wing, and my special guest, Jim Fetzer. We're discussing his very eloquently penned article, Has Cheney Been Murdering Americans with the Cheney Assassination Team? And, you know, I have to ask, I have to pose a question to you, Jim. Do you think it's possible, and we're going to cover a little bit more on this as far as the Jersey Girls and the 9/11 investigation and so forth, but do you think it's possible that these people were getting frightened enough to where they wanted to send a message to the rest of the Jersey Girls to shut up?
Well, I just think this particular woman had made such progress to actually have a conversation with Barack Obama about it that they felt that she was, crossing the line. Now, it could be. I think a lot of these assassinations are intended to send signals. A lot of them are to squelch problems, you know, like the Mayflower Madam had Dick Cheney on her list so that, you know, the next thing we know, the Mayflower Madam, who that told her friends that if she wound up dead, it wasn't because she took her own life, but that the next thing we know is that she has allegedly taken her own life. And it turns out there was another case, very, very personal like that one, involving this woman in Texas, a young black woman who claimed that George W. had raped her, and she was making a fuss about it and bringing a lawsuit. The next thing we know is that she has committed suicide, too. So that, you know, if you can't take them down in a plane crash, well, suicide is always a great fallback. And I'm just telling you, these are very suspicious cases.
Well, you know, it seems to be that air crashes are the most preferred assassination because obviously it's very difficult for anybody, anybody in the mainstream to uncover it. But, we're talking about Deborah Jean Palfrey, and she was just on Alex Jones' show less than 2 weeks before she was suicided because I heard that show. And she said, because Alex asked her the question straight up, you have no intention of committing suicide. And she came out, you know, distinctly saying that, no, she had no intentions of doing that. As a matter of fact, she planned on leaving the country, and she was ultimately going to write a book and expose them all. And I think that's what did it.
Yeah, I think that probably is what did it. This woman, her name is Margie Schrodinger, M-A-R-G-I-E-S-C-H-O-E-D-I-N-G-E-R, Margie Schrodinger, who claimed that Bush had raped her, you know, another suicide. The commentators on my article had brought up some of these cases, and in several instances I added my own remarks about it. So I put links to where you can find the original story about her death, which actually appeared, guess where, not in the New York Times, Michael, but in Pravda. Isn't that something? You can learn more truth about political events in the United States by reading Pravda than you can by reading the New York Times.
Yeah, the only thing you get out of the New York Times is icing on the wings, you know, repeatedly.
they're terrible about 9/11, too. I mean, on JFK, 9/11, this plane crash, New York Times has been an utter failure. And it's really shocking because, I mean, 9/11 has taken place only a few blocks from its headquarters.
Oh, that's part of the reason they had to mortgage their building for $200 million to stay in business and lay off a bunch of workers because they don't report the truth. But see, but they'll stay in business and lose money to keep lying to people as long as the people keep believing them. So that's the world in which we live. Up is down, left is right, war is peace, Jim. You should know that now.
I know.
And if you don't
like
it, you have to ask Scotty to beam me up.
There's another commentator on my article who listed about 20 additional cases which he thinks also were suspicious and where political motivations might have led to you know, taking people out. These are very unscrupulous persons. You mentioned, you know, in the Wellstone case, there were eight persons aboard. There were Paul, his wife Sheila, his daughter Kathleen, and three aides, and then the two pilots, Richard Connery and Michael Guest. And get this, you'll love this, Michael. Not only was it ridiculous, and the FBI could not possibly have known when it announced that there were no signs of terrorist involvement, but it would eventually turn out that Michael Guest actually had a connection to Zacharias Moussaoui, who is alleged to be a terrorist, when he at a flight school in Eagan, Minnesota, gave him access to the simulator for a 747. So not only was it ridiculous for them to claim something they couldn't possibly know when the cause of the crash wasn't even established, but there actually was a link to a purported terrorist.
And Moussaoui, isn't that the guy that they convicted just a couple of years ago?
Michael, this is a bizarre story, okay? He was convicted in 2005, in April of 2005, for participating in a plot to fly a plane into the White House to free the blind sheik who had been involved in the bombing, the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. But in 2006, he's being tried in federal court for the penalty that should be imposed, and they're talking about the death penalty versus life imprisonment. And the grounds for imposing the death penalty was that if he had come forward and explained about, you know, how there was this terrorist plot to hit the World Trade Center, maybe some lives would have been saved. But that wasn't the crime for which he was convicted. So what happens here is that the federal prosecutors are playing a shell game. They're treating him as though he were a 9/11 suspect when he had nothing to do with 9/11. He'd actually made that very clear during his own trial. They put a 10,000-volt stun belt on him, which I imagine made him very cooperative. And they'd go on with this nonsense about, whether he should get the death penalty for not coming forward about 9/11. I wrote a whole column about this, a press release from Scholars for 9/11 Truth. You can find if you go to 911scholars.org, where I pointed out, among other things, that as Webster Tarpley observed to me, under our law with the Fifth Amendment, he didn't have an obligation to come forward and report his culpability or that there was going to be an attack. Number two, as I've already mentioned, he didn't have anything to do with 9/11 anyway. And number three, most importantly, an FBI agent who testified during this trial in Alexandria, and I actually went back and made a statement in front of the courthouse with Phil Berg, who was a former deputy attorney general for the state of Pennsylvania, and with George Nelson, that Air Force air crash expert. And there were about, a dozen cameras there, but we never got even a minute of coverage through any of them. And it would turn out that an FBI agent testified during the trial that he had warned his superiors that he thought this guy taking this flight train might be involved in planning a terrorist act. He even mentioned the World Trade Center. He said later that was a lucky guess. But guess how many times he warned his superiors about this, Michael? It's stunning. If he'd done it two or three times or a half a dozen, you might think that's simple incompetence. When you get up to 24, 25 times, you got to understand it's criminal neglect. He warned his superiors 70 times, which means that there's no way this was simple negligence or ignorance or carelessness. They obviously were keeping these guys under wraps until they could roll them out as the patsies when 9/11 went down.
Well, you know, in light of that, the guy's warning him 70 times, but, you know, that brings up another interesting subject to ponder, and that's the Keene-Hamilton 9/11 Commission that, you know, involved what Beverly Eckert was a part of instituting that. And, you know, the selected individuals that were, you know, Bush came out and said, oh, well, we're going to find the experts. Once they got rid of, what's his name, Henry Kissinger, okay, after the Jersey Girls demanded that they see all of his business contacts.
That's right.
Then they put together a team of experts, and I'm sure that you have gone down the rabbit hole on every one of those people that were assigned to that commission. They all had a conflict of interest. Every one of them did.
Well, the most stunning is the guy, Philip Zelikow, who was put in charge of it and who reputedly ran 10 of the 11 sub-commissions of the commission as a whole with an iron hand. Zelikow actually came from the inner sanctum of the Bush administration. He'd overseen the transition of the national security apparatus from Clinton to Bush. He'd co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice. He'd even published an article in Foreign Affairs where he was entitled Catastrophic Terrorism, where he talked about if the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center had been a success, it would have marked the difference between day and night before and after. The government might have imposed draconian restrictions on civil rights, launched wars of aggression, curtailed, you know, Americans' capacity to exercise their civil rights. I mean, he actually was describing the scenario of what actually would take place after the 9/11 attack in 2001, and this was an article published in, like, 1999. You can actually find it on Stoller's website, along with a Wikipedia article about him that has subsequently been revised, but I captured a copy so it wouldn't disappear, where he describes himself as being an expert, not in history and not in science, but in the creation and manipulation of public myths. Public myths, Michael. This guy was an expert in doing what he was doing, because on 9/11 he was writing a fantastic story about 19 alleged Islamic terrorists hijacking these war aircraft, outfoxing the most sophisticated air defense system in the world, and perpetrating these atrocities under the control of a guy in a cave in Afghanistan. This is completely absurd. If there hadn't been a total interdiction of the normal response between the NORAD and the FAA, which Rumsfeld and Cheney appear to have implemented, there were as many as, Webster Tarpley has turned up as many as 19 alleged terrorist drills that caused it all to shut down.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'll tell you what, we'll continue with this when we get back. Michael Herzog, The American Awakening, with my special guest, Professor Emeritus James Fetzer. Much more to come, folks. Stick around. Folks, we're back with The American Awakening. My special guest, Jim Fetzer, and before the break, we were talking about the 9/11 Commission. And, you know, it's interesting, Jim, that I don't remember when that official report was that came out. I think it was like early 2004, something like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Remember all the mainstream hubbub that came out and all the congrats, you know, the backslapping and so forth? That report may have even gotten some kind of a weird award for, you know, and what they were basically doing is they were congratulating all these perpetrators for the, you know, for covering up the lie so well. Did they indeed get an award for that, Jim? Do you remember?
Yeah, it's very embarrassing. You're absolutely right. In fact, you know, Governor Keene and Hamilton, who are the co-chairs, eventually would write a book about the commission and explain how they were being manipulated and managed by their staff, and how the Air Force wouldn't give them a straight story. In fact, David Ray Griffin has documented three different versions of what happened on 9/11 coming from the Air Force. And it's a tremendous embarrassment. These guys, who I think are basically decent human beings, Keene and Hamilton, were simply manipulated by Philip Zelikow and the staff. In fact, get this, we know now that Zelikow had an outline of the final report a year in advance before he even shared it with any members of the staff, Michael. So that, you know, none of the commissioners knew that Phil Zelikow already knew what they were going to say in their final report before they even conducted their investigation.
Yeah, the name of their book was Without Precedent, and I remember seeing in there that they were questioning. They gave the authority over to somebody else to decide whether they were going to be prosecuted for, you know, perjury or whatever, because there were so many lies that they had detected. But obviously, their hands were tied as well. I mean, the outcome was already, you know, manipulated.
Please,
the outcome was, and the only thing they did is they took the event and they backtracked to make it sound plausible. And even in doing that, and the great amount of effort and the minimal amount of money they wound up spending on it, didn't do a sufficient job. Well, it did for the majority of the American people, because they just assumed turn a blind eye and go back to watching Dancing with the Stars anyway.
we like that show a lot. It's very funny.
Do you? Okay.
I think that this story about Cheney running this assassination ring is causing people to reconsider about major turning points in the history of this administration, including 9/11. I think the American public is going to be much more open-minded about the possibility that the Bush administration was deeply involved in 9/11 after this remarkable revelation.
Well, and that could very well be. Back to Beverly for a moment. I, you know, and you so eloquently pinned in your article, it's a distinct possibility that they took her out because they were starting to get nervous. She was making more headway than they would have liked. And, of course, the last thing in the world, Jim, that they would want to come out is a new independent investigation because they would be caught with their pants down. There's anybody that's a critical thinker, and I commend you, that you're such a great one. Anybody that has the ability to peel away the onion and to look at the facts and connect the dots on it can see. It doesn't take a lot, especially on 9/11. I would say, you know that show that's on TV? I'm not going to get caught with Dancing with the Stars again, Jim. But I'm going to mention, are you smarter? I'm going to mention, are you smarter than a fifth grader?
Now, I've seen that show.
Okay, well, look, you know, let me preface it by saying I don't have a TV that's hooked up, so I don't watch this stuff, but I know people that do. And I think they put Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader on TV to show that the majority of the public are not as smart as a fifth grader, and the powers that be sit behind closed doors and laugh about it, okay?
Yeah,
so they gauge that as the mentality of the average thinking American.
If you can control the information that is received by the American public, you can make them believe anything you want. And that's why the beautiful features about terrorism as an even better political enemy than communism. Communism at least had defined geographical boundaries. You know, we had the Soviet Union and the Soviet menace, but we knew who we were dealing with. They actually had representatives we could negotiate with, we could argue with, and all that sort of thing. With terrorism, it's so nebulous and shadowy and vague. Anything can happen and be blamed on illusory terrorists. The Bali bombing, for example, which killed a lot of Australian tourists, appears to have been a false flag operation. I'm sure it was done by American agents because they were trying to bring Australia into a stronger degree of support with the American war on terror. So the thing to do is to, you know, I think from the description I read in the New York Times, it was a mini nuke that was used in the Bali bombing. I mean, the description of that thing is terrifying when you read about it. But the whole point was they have this political objective of convincing the Australians that they got to sign up with Bush and Cheney, and if you're not with us, you're against us, and all the other happy horse shit that goes along with it.
So
when they
horse
need
poop,
an event,
Jim,
they arrange an event, and they can blame it on anyone. And who can say that they're wrong? See, I mean, it's a very difficult situation because they can play both ends against the middle. They can arrange an event anytime they need one. That's why actually a number of us are concerned now that there might still be another false flag attack, even in the Obama administration, not because Obama is involved with it so much as that there are all these remnants, these little cells, as it were, that are left behind that are devoted to Cheney and Bush. So you got the same Secretary of Defense, and, you know, basically you got the same defense establishment, which I thought originally was a very shrewd move on Obama's part, because then if there were an attack, you could always make the defense. Well, he kept the same Secretary of Defense and the same defense establishment that had been providing us with security during all those Bush years. So that, you know, what more could he have done? But now I'm worried that when you have these guys left behind, that they can continue to perpetrate assassinations on the Cheney agenda, for example, his greatest hits list, or that they can perform other acts of terrorism, including false flag attacks, where a group with whom I do research on these matters, and actually the others are really more sophisticated than I, they have backgrounds in military intelligence, are concerned that Chicago might be the next target. And in fact, we recently issued a warning about this just within the last 4 or 5 days that Chicago may actually be the next target for attack, the Sears Tower in particular.
Well, you know, in my estimation, Jim, I really don't think. I think there's enough people that have suspicions about 9/11 now that I don't believe that their next attack is going to be a false flag. I believe, in my own opinion, okay, I believe that they're going to come off with a pandemic of some sort. bird flu pandemic. But I wanted to mention to you, because we've come full circle back in 2001, you know, 19 Arab hijackers with box cutters were militant extremists, blah, 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 and those were the terrorists. But we've come full circle over the last, close to 8 years now, and now they're starting to point fingers at American people through these fusion centers, MIAC report, the Virginia report that's come out. Do you know about those, where they're starting to say anybody with a Ron Paul bumper on their car or a Freedom to Fashion subversive movie in their back seat, or anybody that believes in the North American Union or the Trans-Texas Corridor or Real ID, we could be terrorists. We're extremists and possibly dangerous, and they're putting these reports out to the respective police departments. Are you aware of that?
Oh, this is an extremely dangerous development, Michael, where they want to create, hate crimes legislation. You know, in Germany today, if you deny the Holocaust, you can be sent to jail. I mean, it's absurd. Everyone should be able to investigate anything they want. Now, I mean, I've been very worried about, the North American Union and all that, the Trans-Texas Corridor. I guess that the Spanish construction firm went bankrupt, though I can't imagine why. Maybe that plan has all been shelved, but it was going to merge Texas, Mexico, Canada, and the United States into one economic entity analogous to the European Union, and we were going to abandon the dollar and the Canadian dollar and the peso for the euro. I'm sure you know all about this, but the fact is I think it was a real genuine issue, and I'm not quite convinced that it's actually dead. But the fact is, if you can't talk about these things, if you can't think about these things as it would have it, I mean, it's ridiculous, then you lose your capacity to figure out what's going on, Michael. You have to have complete freedom of thought, freedom of expression, freedom of research to just figure out what's going on. So this is very sinister, and I think it's part and parcel of efforts to try to, redo the Internet in ways that would privatize it and make it inaccessible to the average person. The fees would have to be paid for its use and all that kind of thing. It's bad stuff.
Jim, yeah, listen, I got on a couple of interesting points here. You mentioned the hate crime legislation. I know we're getting off topic because next hour I want to get into the Pat Tillman debacle, but the hate crimes legislation, there's been a new bill that's been introduced. I don't even think it's got a bill number on it yet that literally expounds on the other hate crime bill, which means that if it's passed and we've got a Democratic Congress, Democratic Senate, and a president that will sign it, Ted Pike has been fighting this like Paul Revere on the airwaves, alternative airwaves, for the last 9 years. We got it defeated last year on the back of a defense plan introduced by Senator Kennedy. But, the bottom line is they introduce and they pass this legislation, and our First Amendment rights are gone. But they're already trying to make us so politically correct in these fusion reports that are being leaked by informing police officers of what to look for. And it's what's so disturbing about it is that it's everything that anybody who's awake already knows to be true. Now, We got a top of the hour break coming up. Go to news for 6 minutes. Jim, go get yourself another cup of coffee or a cup of tea or whatever you want. We'll be back. Third hour coming up, and we're going to get into the Pat Tillman assassination. So stick around, folks. More to come. Be back in six.
I'm not sure I could. They say time heals everything, but I'm still waiting.